Way up north,
north to Alaska.
Way up north,
north to Alaska.
North to Alaska. Go north, the rush is on.
No, welcome to an Alaska Day edition of a Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, host with you today, and happy to be with you on this Alaska Day, which is the day, the anniversary of the formal transfer of the territory of Alaska from Russia to the United States. It took place at a flag-raising ceremony over at Fort Sitka on Friday, October 18th, 1867. So it's not the purchase. It's the formal transfer over. So that's what Alaska Day is. Unlike Seward Day, completely different holiday. Totally different holiday. Don't confuse the two. Don't be one of those people that confuses the two. We've got a great show for you today on a Juno Afternoon. We're going to be talking to David Talman. He's here with us in the studio. He's a professor at UAS and has an interesting talk he's going to be doing about the shifty fishes of Auk Creek. Also, Nancy DeTourney will be here with Arts Up. We're going to be talking to Taku roller sports folks, roller girls, about a roller skating workshop, especially for kids, that they're putting on. And also we'll be getting a preview of Saturday's Coffee and Collections presentation on the City Museum's exhibit on the history of the ANB. That's all coming up in this hour on a Juno Afternoon. First, we're going to be hearing from National Native News.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Tristan Autone, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders gathered in Anchorage Wednesday for a conference hosted by the National Congress of American Indians. NCAI Executive Director Jacqueline Peta says it was a pre-meeting to the Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention, which kicks off today. Peta says the goal of the NCAI conference was to set tribal priorities and prepare them to be put forward to states, the Obama administration, and Congress, as well as to make suggestions on how to solve them. She says funding is among the top priorities.
The concern about the federal debt, and obviously what does any budget proposal mean to tribal governments and tribal programs that are so critical for our tribal members, and whether that be healthcare delivery services or other kinds of support services, Indian education, child care, Head Start programs, all of those are critical to our communities.
Frederick Olson, Jr., board chair of the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, also raised concern over the lack of access to health care and treatment for Native people with rheumatoid arthritis.
This is not always looked at as primary care. So within our current system, it's not all covered. So that's very complicated. The treatment, it's estimated that it might cost each region $1 million or more. That's just for medicine. You see, it's more complicated than just medicine because it's also an emotional issue. So you might need facilities to handle this kind of behavioral health, if you will, problem.
Attendees had a chance to interact with state and federal representatives as well as the White House. A new report shows that tribes in Oklahoma are making a major contribution to the state's economy. As Kirk Courtney with KGOU reports, most of the economic benefit comes from gaming.
The annual fiscal effect from Oklahoma's 38 Native American tribes is nearly $11 billion. The study from an Economic Research and Policy Institute at Oklahoma City University found that tribal government and business operations directly employ more than 50,000 people and support more than 87,000 full-time jobs in Oklahoma. The study also says more than 70% of the $10.8 billion economic impact is related to gambling operations. Seven tribes participated in the study. Chickasaw Nation Governor Bill Anitubby says the report shows the tribes are committed to finding new ways to increase economic opportunities. Choctaw Nation Chief Greg Pyle says the study shows the economic activities of the tribes have a huge effect on Oklahoma, especially in rural areas where jobs are historically in short supply. The study was funded by the Cherokee Nation, the Chickasaw Nation, the Choctaw Nation, and the State Commerce Department. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
Thousands of Native people across the Americas are celebrating the canonization of the Catholic Church's first Native American saint. Known as the Lily of the Mohawks, the 17th century woman is credited with a miracle in the 21st century. North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein reports.
Guadalida Gaguita was born in 1656 in what is now upstate New York to a Mohawk father and an Algonquin mother. Her parents died of smallpox, and the disease left her partially blind. She sought refuge at a Jesuit mission in Ganawage Mohawk territory near Montreal, Quebec. Though she died at just 24 years old, she's revered as a native symbol of pride and hope. Mohawk historian Darren Bonaparte wrote a book about Gudalie de Gaguita.
She's a beacon of empowerment, especially for Native women, because she just didn't sit around waiting for somebody to give her permission. She never sought anyone's approval. She charted her own course.
In 2006, a Native boy in Washington State appeared to be dying from a flesh-eating virus. His family prayed to the Lily of the Mohawks and placed a pendant with her image on his pillow. The boy survived. Last year, the Vatican officially recognized it as a miracle, paving the way for Gudalie's sainthood. For National Native News, I'm David Summerstein in Canton, New York.
During this month in 2007, a World Indigenous Summit was held in Mexico. The Zapatista National Liberation Army and other groups called for unity among the world's indigenous people. This is National Native News. I'm Tristan Ottone.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Hi, this is Jim Strader from Bartlett Regional Hospital. We invite you to join us October 20th at this year's Women's Health Forum, presented by Cancer Connection. This year's keynote speaker will be Dr. Astrid Pajari, discussing how to boost your immune system naturally to help prevent cancer. We're providing a free, healthy lunch and plenty of time for your questions following the presentation. Saturday, October 20th from 11 to 2 at Centennial Hall. The Women's Health Forum is free and everyone is invited.
I mushed from Point Barren through a blizzard of snow. Been out prospecting for 2 years or so. Pulled into Fairbanks, the city was a boom. So I took a little stroll to the Red Dog Saloon.
Well, springtime in Alaska, 40 below. At least it used to be. We know that the climate's been changing, though, and we're going to be talking to Associate Professor of Biology David Tallman about that in just a second. Right now, the forecast for today is numerous rain showers, highs around 39. Mostly cloudy skies is in the forecast for tonight, then mostly cloudy with just a chance of rain and snow showers tomorrow. Mostly cloudy skies for Friday night, then it's going to start clearing, and we've got a long period of clear skies being forecast, partly cloudy and mostly cloudy, partly cloudy skies off and on, with lows around 27 degrees and highs just around freezing. So that's going to be in the forecast for this weekend and the beginning of next week. David Tallman, thanks so much for joining us. And as this song is saying, springtime in Alaska used to be 40 below, but maybe it's a little bit higher degrees now, trending upward as sort of a warming trend has been happening.
Yeah, that's right. So I'll talk a little bit about some of the changes in the temperatures in Ott Creek in particular,
yeah,
and what that means for the fishes there.
So tell me about that. What are some of the climate trends that have been observed in your observations of Ott Creek?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the, and then what's that doing to the fish?
Yeah, well, I guess on a more general scale, you know, in Southeast Alaska, we see really rapid changes in the glaciers. So our glaciers are being lost at a really fast pace, and that's affecting the streams and the amount of cold water that's getting into them, that sort of thing. And
so is it actually – so it's sort of reverse logic.
Actually,
is it actually making the streams colder?
Well, it depends on the stream. So
okay.
Ott Creek isn't glacially influenced.
I see.
And there we do see an increase in the mean temperature. And some of the other streams that are affected by glaciers and have direct glacial input, then we see – colder temperatures for longer associated with melting of the ice water, you know, that sort of thing.
Right. So
so it really varies from place to place. But what we'll focus on tomorrow night is talking about Ott Creek, and we definitely have evidence of an increase in the mean temperature of Ott Creek, and we see responses in some of the salmonids, so that's salmon, trout, and char, to those temperature changes, as well as other changes in the physical environment.
So what does that do? That kind of moves their season, their spawning season? Is that what that kind of effectively does?
Yeah, so we have evidence that, so looking across different species and life histories, we have evidence that quite a few of them are shifting their migration timing into the ocean from Ock Creek and then coming from the ocean back into Ock Creek to spawn. We also see shifts in their migration timing. So I'll talk some about those patterns and what it means.
Yeah, so to give us a little preview, what are some of the patterns and what is it meaning to
Sure. So it really varies among the different species, and then we have different stages of their life histories we can look at. So we can look at them as smolts, which is when the juveniles go from freshwater to the ocean. We can also look at jacks, which are the young males that come back from the ocean earlier than the fully grown salmon, and as well as the fully mature and full-size salmon that come back from the ocean. And looking across all that variation, and 11 out of the 14 life history stages we looked at, we found 11 of those are shifting to earlier timing. So they're shifting earlier in the year. And it varies from species to species and life history to life history. But, for example, with pink salmon smolts as they go out to the ocean, for every a little over a 1 degree increase in temperature, you get about a week earlier migration to the ocean. So the migration timing, all these things, is shifting. And what we've found is that overall, the dates over which they're migrating, in particular adult salmon, is compressed. So there's a smaller window of time in which they're available for harvest by humans and for non-humans like bears and things like that, that of course are keyed into the timing of migration.
Does that also affect them and their numbers? I mean, they have a shorter amount of time to, you know, find a viable mate, do all that stuff that they have to do, right?
Perhaps. Yeah. We don't know. We really don't know about the sort of cascading ecological effects. We just have these patterns that we've observed in Ock Creek. And one of the things that I should mention is that Ock Creek's really an exceptional spot, and we're really lucky in Juneau to have it because it's one of the, if not unique, one of the few places on the West Coast where we have a long-term detailed data set for migration timing of these salmonids. So everything that's gone out and come back in has been counted and completely enumerated. It's like a complete census of all the fishes, the salmonids anyway, and there really isn't anywhere else on the West Coast that they have that kind of data to look at long-term trends and migration timing and things like that.
Right out your front office door too, right? You just walk off the campus and you're there.
Yeah, I kind of pinch myself every day when I go into work and look right out my office window. It's
there's your test.
Sweet.
Yeah, right. There's the environment you're working in. Yeah. What is the reason behind Ock Creek being so well documented?
Well, thankfully, NOAA put a weir on there, and they invested in a permanent weir structure. So they have this really high-end weir that's set up permanent. They've had some great folks who are dedicated to collecting those data every year, Jerry Taylor and John Joyce, local Junoites who've been around for a really long time, have basically made it a huge part of their career to go down there and collect those data every year. And so just due to the fact that they invested in this infrastructure and have kept it going, we have these data sets. So.
Is Ock Creek indicative, though, or typical of a lot of streams that you would find throughout Southeast that spawning is happening in?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a small stream, and it doesn't have glacial influence. So I think a big determinant of the stream behavior is whether or not there's glacial influence. In this case, there's not. But, yeah, there are lots of streams like Ock Creek throughout Southeast. We just happen to be fortunate to have Ock Creek right in our community here.
So what you've kind of just very general, and of course you'll get into this in detail tomorrow night, and give us the time and location of this.
It's 7 p.m., and I believe it's in the Egan Lecture Hall at UAS.
Okay, great. So more in-depth of this, I'm sure lots of time for discussion and that type of thing. But very short wrap up is that the spawning times are shorter, but that the abundance of the stream seems to not have been too much affected?
Yeah, so essentially we're seeing shifts in their run timing and a compression of their run timing, but the overall abundances in the case of the salmon appear to be pretty robust and stable. And so there's both reason for caution but reason for optimism, in the sense that the Ock Creek salmon seem to be doing fine, except that they're shifting. And so the concern, I guess, is will they continue to match the environment and be able to keep their abundances high, or will there be a cost that comes with having to shift your runtime?
Right. Like at this point, they've adapted, but what's the breaking point of the being able to continue to adapt to stream temperature?
Yeah.
Is there comparable studies that have happened on glacially Influence streams?
Not that I know of. Okay. There are really very few long-term continuous data sets on salmon, which is really remarkable. And most of the ones that exist are, say, from down south where there's a real heavy hydropower or hatchery influence. And in this case, Ock Creek's relatively uninfluenced by those forces. And so it's, I think, a unique data set, perhaps in the whole range of salmon.
Wow, that's absolutely amazing to believe, considering the economic importance of salmon and the cultural importance of salmon and all that. That's so little study done in this one particular area.
Yeah, well, it just costs a lot of money to do continuous work, and we have a really great weir here. We're really lucky in Juneau.
Yeah. Okay, so David Talman is the associate professor of biology out at UAS, and he's going to be speaking about what we've just been talking about, which is the study on the shifty fishes, the shifting patterns of their being able to spawn, and the temperatures that are influencing the stream, the climate change that's influencing the stream at Ock Creek. And he's going to be giving that speech out at the Egan Lecture Hall, 7 p.m. It's happening tomorrow night. Admission's free.
Admission's always free.
Are there cookies? Do you know?
I can't guarantee
that. There might be cookies.
I'm not sure. We'll make some.
Maybe some smoked salmon. Yeah. Would be.
That'd be appropriate.
That would be appropriate. All right, David, thanks so much for letting us know about that. And if you are interested further in hearing about this, go check out the lecture. It's happening tomorrow night, 7 o'clock at the Egan Lecture Hall. Thanks again.
Yeah, my pleasure.
The band Dr. Dog with the song Alaska. It's Alaska Day. Yes. We're celebrating it here at K2 with a special Alaska Day version of a Juneau Afternoon. I don't know what's really Alaska Day about this version of a Juneau Afternoon other than the music. But there you go. Yes, it's the anniversary of the formal transfer of the territory of Alaska from Russia to the United States. Happened this day, October 18th, in 1867. So that's what we're observing today. That's why you might have the day off. I hope you're one of the folks that has the day off today. Dr. Dog, Alaska is the song we're listening to, and the forecast for the upcoming week is a good one. We've got some rain we're going to have to deal with, numerous rain showers for the rest of today, and some scattered rain showers and possible snow showers late tonight with lows right around freezing. But then we're going to get into just mostly cloudy skies for Friday night, and then partly cloudy skies for Saturday. Saturday night and Sunday, cloudy skies, and then partly cloudy skies forecast out through next Wednesday, out through Wednesday. So we've got a lot of clearing temperatures, clearing skies coming up here, and lower temperatures as the lows get into the mid-20s and highs around freezing for the upcoming week. So winter is upon us here in Juneau, Alaska, where we're celebrating Alaska Day. We've got some roller girls coming in. Miji Moto and Money Honey are going to be in here from the Taku Roller Sports organization that's going to be doing a workshop for kids coming up this weekend. We got Writer's Almanac coming up in just a second here. And Nancy DeCharney's going to be in with Arts Up. Actually, a lot of artistic activity happening in Juneau this weekend. One thing I want to mention that's happening tonight right across the street from K2 and the Jack is the TGR world premiere of Further. It's a really exceptional movie that's happening across the street at the Jack. There's going to be two showings of that and another snowboard movie happening at 5 o'clock, and that's kind of an all-ages show. And then at 8 o'clock, a show more for the adults as they open up a bar with some refreshments for adults at 8 o'clock at the 8 o'clock showing. So two showings of that, 5 o'clock and 8 o'clock, happening across the street at the Jack. And right now we're going to go on to some Writer's Almanac right after this message.
It's Roundup time again, cowpokes. Time to corral all those old LPs, CDs, and DVDs and put them out to pasture during a used media sale. It's not just a great chance to do some house cleaning, but also time to catch up on some great deals on music and videos during the sale, scheduled for Saturday, October 27th, from 9 a.m. to noon at the KTUO building. Drop off your donations to the station during business hours, and don't forget to stop by the sale Saturday, October 27th, from 9 a.m. till noon at the KTUO building. See you there, partners!
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 18th of October, 2012. It's Alaska Day. It's a legal holiday in Alaska commemorating the formal transfer of territory from Russia to the United States in 1867. It's the birthday of A.J. Liebling, New York City, 1904, writer for the New Yorker magazine for many, many years, wrote about journalism, food, boxing, covered World War II. A.J. Liebling, who said, "Cynicism is often the shame-faced product of inexperience." It's the birthday of Rick Moody, born in New York City, 1961. Had a breakdown when he was 25, had to go into a psychiatric hospital, had to stop drinking, and then learn how to write again without drinking. When he was 31, he published his novel Garden State, about young people growing up in suburban New Jersey. Most recent book is The Four Fingers of Death. It's the birthday of Terry McMillan, born in Port Huron, Michigan, 1951. Her first novel, Mama, came out in 1987. Her big successful novel was Waiting to Exhale in 1992. It's the birthday of Wendy Wasserstein, the playwright, Brooklyn, 1950. Fell in love with theater when she was a young girl, worked hard, wrote some successful off-Broadway plays while most of her friends and siblings were getting married, having children. She started to think about what she had sacrificed by devoting herself to theater, and she wrote a play about it, which became her most successful play, The Heidi Chronicles, 1988. It was on this day in 1896, Anton Chekhov's play The Seagull had its premiere in St. Petersburg. Most of the audience thought it was going to be a comedy and thought it was going to star a well-known actress, and when they realized that she wasn't in the play and that the play was not particularly funny, they rioted, which upset the actors who'd only rehearsed a few times. They kept forgetting their lines. It was a disaster. Chekhov said he'd never write another play, but before the end of the year, he'd started work on Uncle Vanya. Here's a poem for today by W.D. Snodgrass, entitled Lasting. "Fish oils," my doctor snorted, "and oily fish are actually good for you. What's actually wrong for anyone your age are all those dishes with thick sauce that we all pined for so long as we were young and poor. Now we can afford to order such things, just not to digest them. We find what bills we've run up in the stored plaque and fat cells of our next stress test. My own last test scored in the top 10% of males in my age bracket, which defies all consequences or justice. I've spent years shackled to my desk, saved from all exercise. My dentist next. Your teeth seem quite good for someone your age, better than we'd expect with so few checkups or cleanings. Teeth should repay you with more grief for such neglect. Echoing how my mother always nagged, brush a full 100 strokes and would jam cod liver oil down our throats till we'd go gagging off to flu-filled classrooms crammed with vegetables and vitamins. By now, I've outlasted both parents whose plain food and firm ordinance must have endowed this heart's tough muscle, weak, still, in gratitude. A poem by W.D. Snodgrass, Lasting, from his collection Not for Specialists, published by Boa Editions and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app, available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vedder. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This program is made possible by Silver Bow Bakery, now serving local smoked halibut salad on sandwiches or greens with fish from Taku Smokeries. The Silver Bow Bakery, located downtown on 2nd Street, offering fresh local foods prepared to order.
We got a Roxy Roller in the studio with us right now. Michimoto's in here from Taku Roller Sports. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I love your choice of music.
Yeah, Roxy Roller. You can't go wrong with a little Nick Gilder.
Nope.
He's better known for Hot Child in the City, but Roxy Roller, that's the roller derby theme right there.
Yeah, all derby girls are hot children.
Well, you're here. Taku Roller Sports has a really cool thing. It's a kids' skate camp. It's happening. Health on Wheels is the theme. It's happening from October 13th to December 15th. Tell me a little bit about what's going on.
Okay, well, Taku Roller Sports was started to foster a healthy lifestyle for kids and adults, implementing roller skating and roller blading. We're primarily focused right now on introducing skating to kids. So we've partnered with community schools, which we're very excited about, and we have started a kids' skate camp. It's at 1:30 at Marie Drake on Saturdays, and it'll run until December 15th, and we broke it out into three age groups so that the older kids aren't falling over the younger kids, right, and the younger kids aren't as intimidated, and so our
cutting the knees out of the older kids.
Well, us little girls, you know,
that's right.
We can take out those tall kids pretty easily.
That's right.
So, and the goal of it is to right now is because it's a new activity for kids in Juneau, is we need four kids in each age group in order for the classes to continue and for community schools to be able to hold them. And right now, we have four in our first age group, which is 8 to 11s. But we're still looking for kids in our second group, 12 to 14-year-olds. And then our third group is 15 to 17-year-olds.
Now, you can still take kids in all the groups, even
though
you've got four. You've got plenty
absolutely.
Of room.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're especially looking to make sure you've got at least four kids in all the categories so that you can continue. What's the arrangement with community and schools? Tell me about how that arrangement works.
Well, we approached community schools a couple of months ago and said, you know, we Money Honey, my co-coach and partner in Taku Roller Sports, she and I are coaches, and we participate in roller derby. And we approached them and said, you know, we have this awesome idea to get kids on wheels. And many, many women in Juneau are Juneau Roller Girls, and we love them. But we also have a lot of women who aren't active skaters, but they want their kids to be a part of something, and we want to be able to bring that to kids. It's another activity to do to get them off the couch, maybe put down the video games, and get out there and have some fun.
And so
we approached community schools with a whole plan of training and what we were going to do, the objective of the class, and what the class is about. Again, each is broken out into age-appropriate groups, and they run for 1 hour, starting from 1:30 to 2:30 and so on. And the objective is to get them involved in a non-contact sport, because in junior roller derby, it is non-contact, which actually fosters teamwork and working to have awareness of your surroundings.
Tell me how that works a little bit. How do you do non-contact roller derby? Because when you watch roller derby league stuff, like the,
right.
you know, like the bouts that are, well, they're called bouts.
They are.
Right?
They're
and
bouts,
so they're about real physical contact.
Gonna, yeah. Oh, well, I'm a full contact kind of girl. I like to knock folks down. But with the kids, though, we want them to learn about agility and learn about being stable on their skates, work their core, you know, get their endurance up, be able to skate strong. And skating strong is skating smart. And you don't have to knock people down to be a smart skater and to be a good defensive skater. And once they learn those skills and they grow up and they get into adult derby, that just adds on to it. It makes them a more powerful
yeah.
skater.
It's sort of the difference between flag football and regular football.
Right. You're learning
right?
the rules
right.
and the basics of the game. But then once you actually get into the game, then you start learning the more physical aspects of it. With non-contact sport, derby particularly, it's all about owning your real estate on the track. As you can tell from here and in radio world, you can't, but I'm only 5 feet tall. I can own a lot of track because I know how to get low. I know how to extend my legs to own more real estate, but I also know how to move around on the track really fast and get back and forth and back and forth. And so we will teach that skill, and it's all about being agile, being able to look around you, have great peripheral vision, but also working in partnership with your teammates, that you're not a lone wolf out there. It's a team sport. So you want to learn to play with other people and use that to build those walls and to push people back without touching them just by
right.
going slower.
It's exciting to think about young kids getting into this sport because the skill level, once it gets to the point where they're you know, getting into league play is going to just be so elevated.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I
yeah.
mean, it reminds you of, you know, in hockey, if you've got someone who's just a great skater, mm-hmm. they have such a leg up, or it doesn't matter what sort of physicality they have such a leg up already.
Exactly.
Because they can just skate. They're great skaters. And I'm sure that's a big part of what you guys are
it really
teaching.
It really is. It's teaching the basic skating. And our whole plan is we teach the basic skating, and then we assess every week where are they as skaters. And it's a progressive plan and program so that is say for example we're in week 5 we're learning backward skating and you know 6 out of the 12 kids have it and the other 6 do not. Well then we'll keep working on that backward skating so that we're all working together, and the ones who are really stronger we'll pair them up with the other ones and get them to work together and help each other. Again, always fostering that teamwork kind of environment. And then as we move forward, the whole plan is that assuming we can get enough kids, is to have a day of play kind of skate day and on the last day. And that's where parents and friends and family are going to be invited. We'll have a scrimmage where all the kids can play, and we'll break them out by their ages and things like that. But then we'll invite the families to come. Bring your skates, bring your blades. We'll play music. We'll have refreshments, and everybody will get to play. And we'll do it in different segments. So we'll have maybe a 15-minute scrimmage with the peewees. And then the older kids maybe will play for like a half an hour. But in between that, we'll have free open skates and things like that. We'll also have Money and me and a few of the other of our adult skaters doing clinics and things like that, working with parents and things. Because the whole thing is to get the whole family involved mm-hmm. in skating eventually.
Tell me a little bit about equipment. You just mentioned skates and stuff like that. Tell me a little bit about like equipment needs. If someone wants to get into this, what are they going to have to outfit their kid to be wearing and to be using?
Well, I don't know about anything about hockey, but I think the gear and stuff is a lot less expensive.
Okay.
But you do need good equipment, and you don't need to bust the bank to get it. You'll need quad roller skates, but if your child has blades, that's totally fine. They will need knee pads, elbow pads, wrist guards, and a helmet. We prefer they have mouth guards. Even though it's non-contact, there is a risk of fall,
mm-hmm.
and we don't want anybody to get hurt.
Yeah.
Gear, we do have resources for them to be able to get skates and gear. We have a sponsor, 2-in-1 Skate Shop, out of Anchorage, Alaska, who partners with Taku Roller Sports. And they're very happy to put a package together for your child, and they will they offer discounts for Taku skaters.
Cool.
We also have local
Sequence, maybe? Is that
Sequence yeah. is a great place for helmets.
Yeah, okay.
They have great helmets, and they also have pads, but I don't know if they'll have kids' size.
Okay.
But and sometimes played against sports. And then if you can't get what you're looking for there, then there's also Fast Girl Skates online, which is out of, I believe, Seattle area. And they will expedite shipping. And if you tell them that you're in Juneau and not to UPS it, they will ship it priority mail.
Okay, yeah, that's
good tip
obvious
to know.
Yeah, always
ask
the
for
key.
Priority mail.
The shipping is always...
Right, and your average skate package could cost anywhere between about $150 to $200, depending on the skates themselves. But you don't need to go $300, $500, $800 in order to have your kid participate in the program. And through community schools, it's $40.
Yeah. The thing that to me is exciting also about roller derby in general is it's a great sport because it's not one of these sports where you need a specific body type in order to participate, you know?
No.
Like, I happen to play a lot of basketball. Well, if you're tall in basketball, you've got an advantage. It's
just the
way it is. It's not necessarily the way it is at all in otaku, in roller sports in general and in roller derby, where any size person can be incredibly effective.
You know, and I'm glad you brought that up because that's one of my biggest passions about roller derby in general is that, again, I'm only 5 feet tall. I am not an athlete. I didn't play basketball. I hated that. They were bouncing the ball off my head. So I didn't really enjoy that sport. I loved baseball, but I couldn't hit very well. So as I grew up and I was watching TV, watching the morning news, and I lived in Salt Lake City at the time, and they said, oh, we're starting roller derby league. And I said, oh my gosh, I know how to skate. So, and I have always skated. And so I was a speed skater. I actually did ballroom skating. And I thought, oh my goodness, how cool to do roller derby. Tried out, made the league. And the thing that was so impressive about it were the different body sizes. There were tall girls, there were short girls, there were larger girls, there were smaller girls, there were older girls, there were younger girls. I mean, it was so great. I was one of the older ones. And so when the 22-year-old fell and was moaning and groaning, I said, my bones are older than yours. Get up. You know, so it was fun. It was a lot of fun. But the thing that's so neat about it is that I didn't start till I was 42.
Wow, really?
Yes, that's why my number's 42.
There you go.
I didn't start until I was 42. I've been skating for 6 years, and it's one of the most incredible sports because there is this overall sense of accomplishment. My husband says I'm the nicest person until I put my wheels on. And it's pretty neat because when you're 5 feet tall and you're, you know, I'm not like terribly athletic and I can knock someone down and they're going, nice hit, Midgie, you know, it's pretty empowering.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
You know, when I have a friend who, Lady Shatterly, who she's played for probably 6 leagues throughout the country, including some of the top-ranking leagues, and started out in Salt Lake, and she's back there now. But one of my favorite moments is when she said, will you get out from in front of me? Because she was a jammer, and I was a blocker. So it's, yeah,
right.
Size does not matter.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
One thing, it does not matter.
And no matter what size you are, you can participate. So it's a great sport, especially for kids who maybe haven't quite found a sport where
exactly.
They feel like they want to be active in, and it just... It's so important for kids to be active, to try, you know, try athleticism and try sports and just try to find a place where you really feel like you are home and
exactly.
really, you know, want to participate. Yeah,
right. And we have in our organization, one of our cardinal rules is to use the street words. We don't talk smack about nobody. You know, we
right.
don't. We are about inclusiveness, encouraging and building up and about helping one another. And so when we have maybe a skater who's a little bit more advanced, we'll pair them up with someone who's just learning because it offers that advanced skater the opportunity to be a mentor, but it also gives that new skater some one-on-one training.
Yeah.
And so, and again, it, you know, the whole thing about getting kids involved is that, I mean, I am a mom. My kids are grown up now, but I remember my kids sitting in front of the TV playing video games. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, they didn't have these when I was growing up. I was out, you know, building tree forts and skating and riding bikes and stuff.
Right.
And so it's an activity that gets your kids off the couch, gets them engaged, and there's just some kind of cool factor about it, too. You know,
yeah, like, definitely.
I'm a Pete Wee Jr., you know, roller kid. You know, I'm a roller kid. So,
well, tell me a little bit about the details of people wanting to participate in this, get involved in this. What do they need to do?
Okay, so there are a couple ways they can get involved. Definitely contact community schools. You can contact Susanna Ainsworth, who is the scheduler for it, and her phone number is 532 1552, or you can go online to the community school's website, which is through the Juneau School District. If you would like, you can also contact Taku Roller Sports directly, and our email is info@takurollersportsclub.org. And you can email us directly, and we'll send you all the links and everything, because it is directly through community schools, so you register through them.
Is there a deadline here?
Yes, we need to get students registered by this weekend for community schools to continue it for the rest of the time. If we don't, no worries. We'll make a plan B. We will be able to do it through just Taku Roller Sports. So if we had three kids in the 15 to 17s and community schools couldn't support that, then that's okay. We'll do it somewhere else.
Figure it out and get it rolling. Keep it rolling.
Exactly. We want to get kids rolling.
All right. Midji Moto, thanks so much for coming in. Appreciate
you.
You can contact her and find out more about this. Once again, info@takurollersportsclub.org. Taku Roller Sports Club, all one word, .org. And that's how you can find out more information on this and get your kids signed up. Thanks again.
Thank you.
More on Alaska. Here's a great version by Steve Nelson, our own Steve Nelson here in Juneau, of the Alaska flag song. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe you should stand up. Let's all stand
up.
Okay,
I'm standing.
Let's go. You were standing. Sorry.
Eight stars of gold on a field of blue. Alaska's flag, may it mean to you. The blue of the sea, the evening sky. Those mountain lakes with the flowers nearby. The gold of the early sourdough's dreams. That precious gold of the hills and streams. The brilliant stars in the northern sky. The Bear, the Dipper, and shining bright. That great North Star with its steady light. Or land and sea, a beacon bright. Alaska's flag to Alaskans dear. The simple flag of a last frontier. A simple flag of a
I mushed from Point Barren through a blizzard of snow. Been out prospecting for 2 years or so. Pulled into Fairbanks, the city was a boom. So I took a little stroll to the Red Dog Saloon. As I walked in the door, the music was clear. The prettiest voice I had heard in 2 years. The song she was singing made a man's blood run cold. When it's springtime in Alaska, it's 40 below.
When it's springtime in Alaska, it's 40 below.
It was red-headed Lil who was singing so sweet. I reached down and took the snow packs off my feet. I reached for the gal who was singing the tune. We did the Eskimo hop all around the saloon. With a caribou crawl and a grizzly bear hug, we did our dance on a coast. The song she kept singing made a man's blood run cold. When it's springtime in Alaska, it's 40 below.
When it's springtime in Alaska, it's 40 below.
I was as innocent as I could be. I didn't know.
Oh, Johnny Horton there. Springtime in Alaska. It's 40 below. We actually got some colder weather coming this week, but it's going to be sunny out, so that'll be great. Kim Metcalf, how are you doing?
Good, Andy. How are you?
Great. Thanks so much for coming in and telling us a little bit about the Coffee and Collections presentation that's happening on the history of the A&B at the City Museum.
That's right. Saturday morning, 10:30 a.m. The museum does these regularly, and this is the first one of the season. And it's on the 100th anniversary of the ANB, the Alaska Native Brotherhood.
That's really an exceptional history, something that you're obviously a historian of and author of a book on the Alaska Native Sisterhood.
Right.
But, of course, that's the sister organization of the ANB.
Right. And they grew up alongside the ANB, but it is the 100th anniversary of the men's group. And we have a good show planned, I guess you call it a show, a good lecture planned for Saturday morning. In addition to me, my brother Peter Metcalf is going to be there. He has written history connecting the ANB with the land claims issue called The Sword and the Shield, and with the help of Kathy Colcourse Ruddy.
Mm-hmm.
But Peter will be there to talk about that. And then we have Native Elder Marie Olson, who grew up here in Juneau, born and raised here, and she'll talk about the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Alaska Native Sisterhood and her experience with the organizations. And then Ed Coons Jr., who is Cecilia Coons and Ed Coons Sr., of course, his son, and he's also born and raised in Juneau, has a long association with the ANB, and he'll be talking about the organization. So.
Can you tell me just, I'm out of left field here a little bit, this question, but when I'm talking to you and you're kind of mentioning these names, you've had the privilege of meeting most of these people who were so influential in the development of the ANB and of the ANS. And can you just tell me a couple of recollections of some of the most prominent people that you've been able to meet and some of the memories they've been able to share?
Well, I think Peter and I have both been very fortunate that way, and mostly because of our dad, Vern Metcalf, who announced basketball games and got to know a lot of the Native people of Southeast Alaska. But in my experience, mostly with the sisterhood, of course, Cecilia Coons is one of the most prominent people that I got to know. She, of course, passed away some years ago, but she was really an interesting person. Stella Martin. Of course, I knew Stella. I worked for Stella. She was one of my first bosses when I worked at ACS as a long-distance telephone operator. I was still in high school.
Okay.
So she's really a neat lady, and she adopted me, actually, and gave me her name, which is a huge honor.
Yes.
Yonda Yane is the name that I got from her. I've just been able to meet a lot of the prominent Native people, mostly, as I said, through my dad.
Yeah, interesting. So, and that's such a, when you think about it, such a logical connection that it was basketball that sort of was the thing, the common thing that then they were able to form friendships and a bond over.
Yeah. Right, yeah. So, yeah, we feel real lucky that, you know, we have this connection because it's amazing to me growing up here that we lead such separate lives.
Yeah.
And we still do.
It's still to this day. It's true. Yeah. But this this presentation will be a little bit of a bond making a presentation and a ability to learn a little bit about this great history.
Right. And Amy Fletcher wrote a very nice article in today's Empire, and last minute add-on to the lecture is Ishmael Hope. She called him and interviewed him, and I thought, gosh, we ought to get him on, you know, involved too. And so he said he would be down there on Saturday morning too. So,
Great. Yeah,
it should be a really nice group of people talking about a really fantastic historic organization that started here in Juneau in 1912.
November 12th, is that right? Was the first meeting? I think I read that out of your book, maybe. But there was a
U.S. Bureau of Education teachers meeting, and then they got together right after that meeting.
So. Right. Really interesting that Juneau played this really key role, though it was based out of Sitka for many years.
Well, the first camp was organized in Sitka, but the group that organized the Alaska Native Brotherhood did that here in Juneau.
Okay, so, the Juneau's part of the history of Alaska Native Brotherhood. Going to be discussed one more time, the times and all that?
10:30 Saturday morning at the Juneau Douglas City Museum, which is at 4th and Main Street. And everybody's welcome. The coffee is provided by Heritage Coffee, and there will be little breakfast kind of treats, too. So stop by and hear from some very interesting people about an amazing organization.
Sounds like a great morning. Kim Metcalf, thanks so much for coming
in. Thank you, Andy.
Here in Alaska on Alaska Day. Isn't that great, Nancy DeCherney? You are an Alaskan
I was not. I came here when I was two.
2 years. Oh, okay. Shoot. I thought you had. Well, there you go. Well, Kim was.
My siblings were.
You grew up in Haines.
Yeah. That was back in the day.
And now you're in the big city here in Juneau.
Oh, man. Yeah. Used to be a big deal to come to Juneau.
That's right.
Now it's a big deal to go to Haines.
Yes. There you go. Well, tell us. We're, of course, here to talk about Arts Up, all the things that are happening. I think even starting tonight, I know in the Jack, the TGR
in just
film
a few
premiere.
Minutes.
Yeah.
I would have to just note in passing, there was blue sky as I came across the parking
lot.
We've apparently got a couple of weeks
of great, partly cloudy and blue sky weather coming through. Of course, the temperature is going to go down a little bit as a result, but not too bad. Lows in the mid-20s and highs around freezing.
Very nice.
Yeah, so it should be good.
All righty then. Yeah. Okay. So as you mentioned, we've got something happening over at the Jack right away at 5 o'clock. They're going to do two showings of this film, Further, The Journey is the Reward. This is a snowboarding film. Alaska Powder Descents is bringing it in.
And Teton Gravity Research is the filmmaking company, and they're world famous and do incredible stuff. I get to be the host of this over. I'm emceeing this.
Well,
I jump out of this chair. I know. I've got to run across the street in a minute.
It's
You're
sunny.
Keeping
Don't
me.
Worry. Anyway, they're going to do two shows, and it looks like Eagle Crest has got season passes for sale, and
there's door prizes and all kinds of stuff like that. It's going to be a lot of fun.
They're getting all set up over there. It's $15 in advance. You can get tickets at Sequence. I don't know. They may
Aurora
have stopped.
Project,
they may have stopped the advance ticket sales.
I don't know. I
don't know about that.
I think they've just dropped off tickets at Aurora Project, of course, at the Jack.
I don't think we have any.
No, there's none over there either?
Anyway, do come. And the 8 o'clock show includes a beer and wine garden,
yes.
So it'd be a nice event happening. And at 5:30 out at UAS is Machiopolis. It's one of those environmental film series that's being offered.
Oh, very cool.
It's free. It's an award-winning documentary about the effect of globalization of the various things on workers in Tijuana. So it sounds depressing.
Well, but important.
But important,
yes.
And good to know. And I'm glad people, you know, so if you're out there, that's a good thing
you're
to do.
You're not supposed to say that.
Well, come on. Let's
get real.
Let's be honest say that some things are not always that And you know, it's not always a Disney film.
Yes, absolutely.
So,
important
okay.
to know about.
Friday at noon, we got the Kimball Organ things, of course. Big weekend on Friday. 6:30 p.m., it is the Grand Slam Poetry Championship, Wishkina Dei. That's going to be over at the Jack. Starts at 6:30. Suggested donations for that.
This is a big deal.
It's a big deal.
It is. The slam poetry thing is so fun and so cool. And, yeah, they've been working hard and competing.
And they've been doing
battling.
It for 2 years. So
yes.
this is the big slam down or something.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's going to be exciting.
Smackdown and the Jackdown.
I guess so.
I guess that's right. I don't know.
Let's go back to where we started.
Yes.
7 p.m. evening at Egan has, they're discussing what can the shifty fishes of Auk Creek tell us.
Now, we just talked to David Tallman about that
and
just earlier in the show.
It's
absolutely fascinating. Okay. Climate change is affecting the fish there, and you'll hear more about it at UAS Egan Lecture Hall.
It's at 6 or 7 o'clock, and it's free. And over in the library at UAS Egan Library is China's Legal System, the Prospects for Reform. This is a presentation brought to us by the Juneau World Affairs Council. So you could be out at university and just have to decide what to do.
Yes, back and forth.
Back and forth, back and forth. There's also beginning merengue lessons. At 6:30, there was beginning swing dance at the Pavitt Health and Fitness. And then at 8 p.m., there's beginning merengue. So
nice.
You can be doing that, too.
All right.
All righty. Saturday, 8 a.m., there's in-home hospice volunteer training. This is at the Old St. Anne's Hospital, which is up on 6th and Gold, and it's free, but they would ask that you pre-register. So 463-6169 if you're interested in that. 9 a.m., fun times over at the Douglas Public Library. A performance workshop for storytellers with Roblyn Gray Davis. This is being offered by the Friends of the Public Library, so it's free. Roblyn, as you know, is a fantastic performer,
yes.
storyteller. If you saw Mice and Men, he was just in that.
And he asked that you bring a story of your own, sort of a written story, or you know, have it, and then he'll work with your story and help you one on one and within the class. And it's a great opportunity to.
I think you get to hear a lot
thing.
Of good stories,
yes,
too.
Yes, also.
Yeah, so suggested for teens to adults, and go on over for that at 9 a.m. on Saturday. There's also community emergency response team training, which is happening out at the Hagavig Regional Fire
that
Training
That sounds exciting.
Center. Well, this is number 5 to 7 out of 8 sessions, and I don't remember exactly what the topics are, but it's always good to be prepared.
Yes.
So this is a good, if you're interested in
they
that
They might
kind
burn
of stuff,
something. Maybe they'll burn something.
Andy?
I don't know. Blow something up?
I don't know. Right. Okay, over at the Canvas at 10 a.m., they're doing scareware. I think this must be a pottery thing going on. That's at 586-1750 to get more information. You're just talking to Kim, about the Coffee and Collections, which is up at the museum. And you know, the City Museum is free during the wintertime thanks to gifts from people. And I believe October's gift was from the Pioneers of Alaska. So
it's awesome, isn't it?
It is.
Such a great way to sponsor culture in Juneau, sponsor admission to the City Museum for a month.
And Heritage Coffee provides the coffee for these talks that they do. They do them monthly, I believe. And this one sounds like it's going to be fascinating.
So it's not just any old coffee. It's good coffee.
And it's home-baked baked goods.
Nice.
Too. That's very nice. At 11 a.m. is one of my favorite annual events. It is the Gastineau Humane Society Pet Fest.
The Pet Fest.
Goes until 5.
It ruins the Jack for a whole year.
Oh, come on. We have a great time over there. They have pets in costumes. There's all sorts of games and contests and all sorts of fun. So, the proceeds for this event benefit the Gastineau Humane Society. Come on over, and it runs, like I said, from 11 till 5. There's also over at Centennial Hall, starting at 11, the Women's Health Forum, boosting your immune system naturally for cancer prevention, is one of the featured topics. That includes a healthy lunch, and I believe this is free. It's from the Cancer Connection.
Nice.
So you can be doing a couple of things, right down, park your car in one location, run back and forth between pets and health.
I'll give a little preview on another Cancer Connection event that's happening next week, next Friday, Battle of the Bands, Battle Against Cancer. KXLL is putting this on. It's happening at the Jack. And it's proceeds for that, part of the proceeds for that are going to go to the Cancer Connection.
So that helps pay for the health forum.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah, fun weekend or during the day on Saturday there. Watercolors, still life studies class at the Canvas at 2. And at 4 p.m., you want to talk about the Festival of Seafood?
Yes, certainly. The Festival of Seafood, it starts off with a beer tasting that from provided by Alaska Brewery. So we partner with them every year on this. And that is a really exceptionally cool thing because you have the brewers come out from behind the curtain and they reveal all their secrets about why this tastes this way and what to look for in all the different brews. They often bring a special kind of rough draft sort of brew that you get to taste as well. So that's a very cool. And then the Festival of Seafood, it's, of course, halibut and salmon. It's all you can eat.
You got Abby's Seafood, Taku Fisheries,
right,
all sorts of people.
Abby's Kitchen is helping with it, and Taku, and all that. All the people are helping out with that, and it's just a great. It's a great annual event. It's sort of like it's sort of the. We can do this fall thing. We can do it.
We can get through we can October.
We're going to get through this because the Seafood Festival helps us get through it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a lot of fun.
And it's a fundraising event for public radio. So that's something else to do. 7:30 p.m. This is really interesting. Rory Stitt, local guy.
Opera.
Is Opera to Go is working with him to write an opera for... It's for all ages, but appropriate for children. It's called Bennu's Birds. It's got a cute little story. Now, when I a long time ago, I used to live in Seattle and go to these things where authors or playwrights would do like a read-through of their play, and then they would ask for audience to say, you know, you really lost me back there in Act Two when the so-and-so did that. And that's what this is. This is the workshopping of this opera. It's not ready yet, but they're to the point
half-baked.
Where it's half-baked. It's a half-baked opera, but they are looking for audience to let them know how they're doing, where they're going, what, you know, what's strong, what's weak, and all that sort of stuff. You get two opportunities to participate in this. It's at 7:30 on Saturday or at 3 p.m. on Sunday, and it's at Northern Light United Church. There are tickets available at the Jack and Hearthside Books and online, but it should be very interesting to know that
this
is happening.
That's really cool. I didn't quite put it together that that's what was happening. I just saw that Rory had been working on this opera, but it's really, that's such an opportunity to be able to have some input on an artistic work like that.
Yeah, and just to see how it gets done. It's called workshopping, I guess, and then just see the inner workings, the behind the scenes.
Okay, we've got a minute left here.
Let's hear the highlights. 9 p.m., you got the third annual three-ring improv with a Second City person, Amy Roeder. That's going to be at the Goldtown.
Exciting, coming in from Chicago. There she is, a real Second City person.
We've got, let's see, we don't want to miss on Sunday at 7 p.m. the Juno Cabaret over at the Jack. They've got Suwana Cafe is going to be there with food and beer and wine. And on
great Monday, Thai food. Oh,
yeah,
that's
cabaret singing.
Yes.
What can we do?
Yes. Monday
is the Arts Roundtable. Usually we have it the last Monday, but we're having Break Reality on the last Monday. So instead, we'll have our Arts Roundtable this coming Monday, and we're going to be talking about evaluation and survey ways to do that.
That's it. That's all you've got for Arts Up. I'm sorry, because we've got to go to NPR Headlines right now.
Everybody needs to go to the website and get the rest of the deal.
Sounds good. Here's NPR Headlines.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston.